Tonight, we are beginning in the book of Genesis, the sixth chapter, and we're beginning in about verse 5. Is that where you had marked? Down to verse 8? Yeah, okay. Yeah, what it is, I went back up and overlapped a little bit in my study, I think. In chapter 6 and verse 3, notice that it says, "The Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. That is to say, the Lord is saying through Moses here, it's going to be 120 years until the flood. And we find that it was 120 years from this point until the flood. And in verse 5, God saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. So God looks down very sadly, and verse 6 says, it repented the Lord. Now remember from the Acts class, you learned that just the simplest definition of repent is to change your mind. So here God changed his mind, as it were. He repented that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. Now you can get all kinds of questions here. Well, was the Lord really sorry that he ever made man? If that was so, how did God not know in his omniscience that man would do this and therefore not make him to start with? And then someone says, well, God in his omniscience and his omnipotence has the power to limit his all-knowingness. And so God limits his own self, his own knowledge. I don't believe that. I believe that God is omniscient, and I believe that he's all-powerful, and I don't believe that God has ever limited himself in any way. There are those who, I heard in a debate one time, a man said, name something for me that God ever didn't know. And the answer of a man who was a Christian, Jim, this is a attendance sheet being handed up to you, the man who was a Christian said, well, one thing that God didn't know was what Abraham would do when he offered his son, because after Abraham was willing to offer his son on the altar, God said, now I know. In other words, before he didn't. And that's not so. The language of the Bible is written accommodative so that we can see the scene of human events as God views it. For example, in the case of Abraham, God knew all along what Abraham would do. It's just like a chemistry professor that knows what will happen if you mix chemical A and chemical B. But he holds them both up to the class and he says to the class, what will happen if we mix chemical A and chemical B? And he pours them together. And he says, now we notice that if we mix chemical A and chemical B, now we know that the formula turns green and foams over out of the test tube. Now, he already knew that that would happen, but now he's demonstrated it before the class. What he's saying is, now we know by demonstration. Now we have shown it. So when God said about Abraham, I have no doubt that God knew what Abraham would do. He knew his heart. He knew everything about Abraham. But God said, now I know. Now I have shown by demonstration. We've exemplified it. We've shown it not only to you, Abraham, but to all of the world that would come after you and read about you as an example of faith. And so, in this particular case, the idea that God repented, it repented the Lord that he made man, simply shows God's dealings with man and his view towards them. God was exceedingly sorry, and it grieved him at his heart. The whole idea of God having a heart or an emotional seat, you see, it's putting God in language that we can understand how God is feeling about this thing. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and the creeping things and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace. Now the word grace is the word that means favor. It often means unmerited favor. The nth degree of God's grace is always unmerited, but sometimes it is merited on the basis of one's character. And we find that that's the case in connection with Noah, because verse 9 says, And these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. So this describes his character. And then it says, and Noah walked with God. Now in the fifth chapter, in verse 23, you've already read about someone else that the text says walked with God. Who was that? A man named Enoch. He walked with God, and God took him. We read in 2 Peter, the second chapter in verse 5, it might be a good idea just to turn over there and read, that Noah was a preacher. It says, and God spared not the old world, but he saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. So here we find that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. All 120 years before the flood, Noah was preaching. Now, whenever I get to feeling a little bit depressed about the work that I did up in Canada, and when I left there after 3.5 years, we had about 30 people meeting, all I need to do is sit and think about Noah and about the fact that Noah worked for 120 years and was only able to save himself and his wife and his sons and their wives, eight souls all total. And also, when churches are supporting preachers in foreign fields, and they don't have baptisms just every month because they're not baptizing the children of members in a big church of 200 or 300 or 400 people, they need to remember Noah. There are a lot of churches that unless it's not good enough just to support a preacher, he has to be producing. God does not always demand results. That is secondary. They demand that he be, first of all, a preacher of righteousness. And there are a lot of brethren today that if they had been supporting Noah in this foreign field, they would have said, we've got to cut him off. Obviously, he's not productive. But what did God say about him? God said he was a preacher of righteousness. He was a man approved in the sight of God. And so that's something to remember when you're supporting preachers that are working in difficult fields. And Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, I want you to write down these three names because I'm relatively certain that when Greg gives you a test that he's going to ask you the names of the three sons of Noah. You may not be accountable for the exact spelling, but be sure that you can write these down the approximate way that they sound. Verse 11 says, the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. You know, that just almost sounds like today, doesn't it? It seems like one of the major problems of our day is violence. Read about every morning in the paper how many rapes and murders and muggings there were. And there was a special on television recently about violence. Incidentally, there's some evangelical preacher up in Wisconsin or somewhere that has started this movement. I think that it's to begin this next Saturday night at midnight, which is a protest against the sex and violence on our televisions. It's going to be Turn Off Television Week. The thing has spread all through the United States and Europe and all through Canada, and it's really taking on. And what they're advocating is at midnight this Saturday, you unplug your television and leave it off an entire week, and then write letters to your congressman and to the heads of CBS and NBC and ABC in protest of the filth that's coming in our homes. Well, violence is rampant today. This sounds a lot like Houston. And so God saw that the whole earth was filled with violence, and God detests this kind of thing. And so he looked down upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. Now, you read about the reason that this happened in verse 2 of this chapter. There were certain people that God dealt with as being particularly his. And I don't know all the answers about who the sons of God were versus the daughters of men. But you notice that the way the whole race originally became corrupted was that godly people married ungodly wives, and it corrupted them. Now, there's a lesson in that for Christians, and that is if you're a young Christian man or a young Christian woman, when you're looking for somebody to spend your life with, you look for a Christian, if you can possibly find one. If not one who's already a Christian, then you try to find one who is kingdom material, someone who will be will probably obey the gospel, someone that would not be antagonistic to the Lord and his will, or you're in trouble. And even if you do survive the ungodliness that an ungodly mate brings upon you, it'll still have a profound effect on your children, and your children will be pulled apart and maybe then grow up not to value the Lord and His Word. And so that's a very important consideration, and that's how it happened. In verse 13, it says, "And God said unto Noah, The end of all flesh is before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth." And so here where God makes his decision, and he announces to Noah what his decision is. I'm going to destroy the earth, it's filled with violence. So verse 14, he begins to make some instructions to Noah. "I want you to make an ark, Noah, and you make it out of gopher wood." Now today, we do not know what gopher wood was. There's a number of suggestions as to what it might have been, but we're unsure as to what it was. "Room shalt thou make in the ark, and shall pitch it within and without with pitch." In other words, he was to take tar, and he was to paint this hot tar. You've all seen them putting tar on a roof. And he was to put tar all over the ark on the outside and on the inside. And this pitch was to be a kefer, or a covering. And that's actually what made it waterproof, you see. And verse 15, "And this is the fashion which thou shalt make of it," or it of. "The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits." Now, a cubit was the length from a man's elbow to the tips of his fingers. And usually it was judged as about 18 inches. Sometimes a cubit was as long as 22 inches. You may want to look that up in your Bible dictionary. But it's easy to figure this out if we just take it, say, a foot and a half. Back then, men many times were bigger than they are. There were giants in the earth, and people were bigger than they are now. American men today are getting larger than a couple of generations ago, and these things have ways of fluctuating. But if you say 18 inches, then the length of the ark, being 300 cubits, would have been about 450 feet, as you can see. Now, how long is a football field? 300 feet. So how many football fields would this have been? 1.5 football fields long. And the breadth, that is wide, 50 cubits, and that would be how many feet? 75 at 18 inches per cubit. And the height of it, 30 cubits, and that would be 45 feet tall, all right? Now this room is probably about, well, I'm a little over 6 feet tall, so this is a little over 7 feet. Right here, to the room here, 7 feet tall, or eight, maybe eight feet. Okay, so the ark would have been possibly almost six times as large as this, six times as large as this room right here. That would have been how high it was. Most people agree that the ark was probably constructed like a barge, just like a big box. One of the interesting things is that the ratio here of 45 by 75 by 450 is approximately the same ratio that ships are made today. But there's no indication that it had a prow, you see, that it came to a point like this. I saw the movie here about Noah's Ark, and it told about how they created a turbulence thing, showed it, and they built a box, a thing. It was just almost impossible in the turbulence to turn this thing over. It floated so well. Now, they were to put a window in the ark, and in a cubit shalt thou finish it above. It's very probable then that this window, it wasn't just a little square window like you would have somewhere, but it was a thing that went around the entire ark, just like a slit. And this was to let air into the ark, and it was to let light into the ark, you see, later on. Now then, "And the door of the ark shalt thou set in the side thereof, with lower, second, and third story shalt thou make it." So the ark had three stories. Now, this really doesn't tell us what the ark looked like. It's just like I said, if I said, my house, I have a house, and it is 12 feet tall, and it's 45 feet by 60 feet, and it has seven rooms in it, and it has 18 windows. What does my house look like? Well, there's not one of you in this room that could draw a picture of it. There are so many combinations, you see. this is not the full set of instructions that God gave to Noah. Moses is just recording for us the general facts about what the ark was like, but it doesn't tell us what it really looked like. And behold, I, even I, do bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, wherein is the breath of life from under heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. But with thee will I establish my covenant. Now we're going to, you mark that word down, covenant. A covenant means an agreement between two parties. And God, all through the Old Testament, makes covenants with people. He made a covenant with Moses, and now we're living in a special covenant, the covenant that he made with us through Jesus, which is also called a testament. And so God said, I'm going to make a covenant with you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with thee. And of every living thing, now that made, you see, if you count all these people up, he says, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with thee, that made a total of eight, didn't it? A total of eight persons. And of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark to keep them alive with thee. They shall be male and female. Now this doesn't contradict what he's going to say later on. He's going to say that of the clean animals, they're to bring seven of every kind, seven pairs. And so really what he's saying here is you're just going to have a couple of every particular kind, of fowls after their kind and of cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive. Now notice this phrase in verse 20, two of every sort shall come unto thee. Later on we're going to read some other indications that God called the animals into the ark. Because when God finally told him, it's time to go in, now get all the animals in, he just gave him 7 days. And if God told you, I want you to go out and round up two of every kind, a male and a female, of deer and raccoons and squirrels and every kind on the face of the earth, and you've got 7 days to do it, I'm sure that you'd just say, well, I may as well quit before I even start because it's an impossible task.
Some would say that during some years when he was building the ark, during the last few years back, that his sons may have been helping him collect the animals over a period of several years. That's just one viewpoint, but that would be a consideration, not just the 7 days. I mean, he didn't know exactly when, of course, they were to go to the ark. Mm-hmm. He had the animals ready.
That's interesting. I don't believe that, but
it doesn't say either way, really. But, you mentioned that it was not called the animals, so that could have come from
right. That's true. I'm sure he was making the cages, but it's not my impression that Noah was doing two things. He was building this ark, and he was preaching. And it's not my impression that Noah really had to exert any effort in terms of rounding up the animals. Okay, in verse 21, he says, and take thou unto thee of all food that is eaten, and thou shalt gather it to thee, and it shall be for food for thee, and for them. Thus did Noah, according to all that God commanded him, so did he. Now, at this point, there's no indication that man had ever eaten animals up until this point. If you read later on, it says there were herbs for food. Now, there was the death of animals, because when God made Adam and Eve clothing, he killed some animals and made them some skins, didn't he? And when you read about the sacrifice of Cain and of Abel, you read that God there had Abel that was offering the more perfect sacrifice. He was offering animal sacrifice, and Cain was offering of the fruit of the ground. So there was the killing of animals for sacrifice. But there's nothing that actually says, that man had ever eaten any kind of animals. So it might have been that this was just plants and vegetables and plant-type food. Were you? Clothing.
And the significance of the sacrifice in that it's something, I mean, other than just the wool that indicates they.
I don't know. Maybe so. You know, I couldn't be dogmatic about that one way or another. It might have been that he was raising them for their skins, for the clothing. Now that wasn't until later on, see. Now we're gonna hear him talk about clean and unclean animals. And it might be that God had talked to Noah and various righteous ones before and told them what clean and unclean was, but really the idea of clean and unclean animals was not clearly defined for us until you get over into the law of Moses. See? So I don't know what all God had told man about clean and unclean animals at this point, and there's no way that I could prove at this time that man had ever eaten animals. So I do know, though, that in verse 21, that this food that he's to take in for it and for them, I think was vegetables and so forth. Now, there's later on we're going to see some other things that he did that will perhaps help explain this. Thus did Noah, according to all that God commanded him, so did he. Now, that tells you something else about the character and the caliber of Noah. Now, would you imagine that as Noah, that crazy old man, is out there building an ark on the Chaldean desert, and here's 120 years. You see, it's going to take a long time to build an ark that big. Can you imagine the work that it would take? And Noah's just got his three sons helping him, the wives. And here they are out building a boat, this tremendous boat that is as large as the largest of battleships in the U.S. Naval Fleet, 1.5 football fields long. Do you imagine that he would come in for some ridicule? Certainly he would. Why, that crazy old man. And Noah's saying, God is going to bring a flood on the earth and he's going to destroy you. You better repent. And they're just laughing at him all the time. Now, that also tells you something about Noah's character. He had to have some real strength to continue doing this in the face of all of this opposition and undoubtedly this laughter. The Lord said unto Noah, come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation. Noah and his family stood out in the generation in which they lived. Of every clean beast thou shalt take to thee by sevens, the male and his female. So here you have the introduction of something else. See, this is not a contradiction between God, what he had already said. This is just an addition. That's just like if I tell Beth, Beth, I want you to go down to the store and get me a packet of paper in about 15 minutes. And then when the 15 minutes are up, I say, Beth, go down and get me a packet of paper and also get me a box of pencils. Well, I haven't contradicted myself. I have just explained a little more and added something that I want there. The male and his female and of beasts that are not clean by two. The male and his female. Now, to define a clean animal, okay, Didi? There was a distinction, but what I was saying is that unless God had spoken privately to Noah and some others, any instructions as to what a clean animal was and an unclean animal was had not cropped up until this point.
But then, if you go back to what they were saying, if they were eating animals, mm-hmm. then it would make sense that they would take more of the clean animals that they would be eating. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know whether... I don't know whether they had been given instructions as to what animals they could eat and what animals they couldn't. That all came in. For example, it seems to me like these impositions were not bound on the Jews while they were in Egyptian bondage and so forth, that these laws were only given after they came out of across the Red Sea, and then God told them some animals you can eat of and some of them you can't. That's true. Now, what did an animal have to be like to be clean in God's sight? First of all, it had to have a hoof.
That's sort of where he starts setting the
straight. Yeah, I'm going over into Moses to define a clean animal for you, since he doesn't do it here. Well, that's possible. But I'm just assuming that whatever was a clean animal when you get over in Moses' law was a clean animal here. Had to have a hoof. So that would mean a horse, cow. But then you had to have another restriction, that is, the hoof had to be split. It had to be a cloven hoof. So you couldn't eat a horse, could you? Could you eat a cow? Okay. It had to chew the cud. Does a rabbit chew the cud? A rabbit chews the cud, but it doesn't have a hoof. Now, what is it to chew the cud? Well, cow. A lot of animals chew the cud. What it is to chew the cud? We don't have many farm boys and girls here. Okay, they eat and then they regurgitate their food and they chew it a while and then they swallow it again. Then they do that again, and that's how they eat their food. Now, we're going to see later on why he has him do this. It may partially have been for food for the family while they were in the ark. And then later on, we're going to see that Noah is going to offer some sacrifices of these clean animals to God, a very generous sacrifice. Also, the fowls of the air by sevens, the male and the female, to keep seed alive upon the face of all the earth. For yet 7 days I will cause it to rain upon the earth, 40 days and 40 nights. And every living substance that I have made will I destroy from off the face of the earth. And Noah did according unto all the Lord had commanded him. And Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. And Noah went in his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him into the ark because of the waters of the flood. So it starts raining, it appears. All of this starts happening. And they go in. Now, really, I'm not too certain about this. It might have been that God just told them to go in before it ever started the raining. And then it's going to tell us that God, where does it say that God shut the door? Oh, down in verse, yeah, okay, and down in verse 16. And they that went in, yeah, this is after the animals get in. And they that went in male and female of all flesh, as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in, so that it appears that God closed the door and sealed it up. Now, notice in verse 8, of clean beasts and of beasts that are not clean, and of fowls and of everything that creepeth upon the earth, there went in two and two unto Noah into the ark. Now, during this 7 days, the animals start pouring into the ark. Now, as to whether they had, as Jim suggested, been gathered up and were in corrals around there before this happened, I don't know. But you can imagine what a phenomenon that would have looked like of all these animals, streams of animals, hundreds and thousands of animals, coming into the ark, voluntarily walking into that thing. And, you know, I think that if I would have been the wickedest man alive then, I might have had some doubts as to, you know, well, maybe this old Noah did have something. Maybe he did know something. The same way that God can make the salmon go out the rivers and go out into the Pacific Ocean and swim around for 7 years and then come around and finally swim up the same tributary and go up the same little river and the same little creek and same area and go back to the very place where they were born and then lay their eggs and die. The same God that can make an animal do that, that can make a pigeon be able to find its way thousands of miles home, that God can certainly call the animals and have them come into an ark, the God who created them. And so God did that. And it came to pass, notice that it says then, it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. And here's when it started. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. Now the water came from two directions. The fountains of the deep were broken up simply means that the oceans, the middle of the oceans, started giving, belching up water. And secondly, it starts coming down on the earth. Now, this is the first record that you have in your Bible of it ever raining. I think that one of the reasons that the people might have ridiculed Noah was that the idea of it raining, why, that's just ridiculous. That's just absolutely stupid. Water coming out of the sky, that the process of precipitation had never occurred. One thing you do read about, if you turn over to Genesis, the second chapter in verse 6, is there it says, but there went up a mist from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground. You know what a mist is. In other words, like a dew on the ground. But notice here the process is different. The mist comes up from the earth and it waters the ground. And you remember that when God was going to prove something to someone one time, he said, you put out your fleece and I'll make it be damp on the fleece and dry on the ground. The next time I'll make it dry on the ground and or I'll make it wet on the ground and dry on the fleece. You remember that story? So there was a mist that came up, but this is the first record of it ever raining. And God opens the windows of heaven. And the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Now, I don't think that probably many of us in this room really have any conception of how much water there really is on the planet Earth. Now, I'm told that if you were to level all of the mountains and raise all of the valleys and just completely level the earth, that there would the whole earth would be covered by about a mile and a half of water deep. In addition thereto, if you melted all of the glaciers and the water that is in the form of ice at the North Pole, the entire earth would be covered with about 1,200 feet of water. Now, that's just phenomenal. In fact, I read somewhere the other day that in the Pacific Ocean, there are 300 million more acres of water than there is land in all the continents on the earth. Now, that lets you know something about the magnitude of water. One time when Linda and I were on the Olympic Peninsula, and overlooking the Olympic mountain range, we went up to a place there called the Hurricane Ridge, which they have glaciers up there all the time. And the forest ranger was talking about the glaciers and about the magnitude of water and about if all of this water started melting and if the glaciers on the mountains of the earth all melted and ran down, how much the water level would rise, and Seattle would all be underwater, New York would be underwater, all of the Gulf Coast of Texas would be underwater. There's just a plateau in the Midwest that would, of all the United States, that would still be above water. Now that just gives you some idea of the volume of water on the face of the earth. So, verse 13 says, in the selfsame day entered Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them into the ark. They and every beast after his kind, and all the cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth after his kind, and every fowl after his kind, every bird of every sort. And they went in unto Noah, unto the ark, two and two of all flesh, wherein is the breath of life. Notice in verse 15 this phrase, and they went in unto Noah. And notice in verse 9, see the same phrase, there went in two and two unto Noah into the ark. So the animals went unto Noah into the ark. So it wasn't as though Noah was out here behind them driving them like cattle, but they were coming in unto him. All right, verse 16, and they that went in male and female of all flesh, as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. And the flood was 40 days upon the earth, and the waters increased and bare up the ark. That is, it was lifted up on the water, and it was lifted up above the earth. And the waters prevailed, and there increased and were increased greatly upon the earth. And the ark went upon the face of the waters, and the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. Now, I would understand that to mean that the water came to about 22 to 23 feet above the highest mountain. And all flesh died, verse 21, that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle and of beast and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man. All in whose nostrils was the breath of life of all that was in the dry land died. Now, those of you who may have seen the movie about the ark and the search for Noah's ark, you saw how Noah is preaching, and as they're building the ark, they're up there sawing and building on the thing and working on the thing, and there are people from the town that come up and look at him. Look at the crazy old man, and they're laughing at him all the time, continually laughing at him. And then when the rains start coming down, it shows the people, and they're, oh, rain, you know, and they're kind of perplexed, and I guess they've never seen it before. I don't know whether they tried to make that point in the film or not. But it's kind of a lark, and then it starts coming down just like solid torrents of water, just coming down in sheets. And there begins to be a little murmur, and then there's a panic, and then the people start running towards the ark. And Noah is up there in there at the window, and in this particular movie they showed it as there being just a small window that he holds back, and the window is back, and the people are pounding on the side of the ark. Noah, open up. You know, it's like people trying to get in a bomb shelter in case of a nuclear catastrophe. And please open to us. And then they get panicky, and here's a woman trying to hold up her baby, you see. Take the baby. And finally Noah closes the window. And then you start seeing the torrents of water start coming, chunks of earth start falling, and you see the people. Now, for example, if water started coming, if there was a tidal wave started coming in from the Gulf of Mexico, what would people here start doing? Well, they'd get in their cars, and everywhere they could, they'd start moving for higher ground, wouldn't they? Some people might get into high buildings and try to go up to the top of the building. When you got to a hill, maybe there'd be a mountain there, and there'd be women and children, and these aren't Christian people that have any respect for life. These are not godly people. But if you can imagine the atrocities of people fleeing for refuge in a state of panic, you can probably picture grown men taking children and women and just throwing them off the mountains, doing anything to try to get to the top, just anything to preserve life. In the Chicago fire that started in this great theater many years ago, they found bodies heaped against the door, 40 stacked, 40 people high. In other words, people just climbed over people, just trying to get to the door. When they finally, here were these singed mass of bodies, people trying to get out. So if you could just use your imagination a little bit to picture this. Now, this may seem like a cruel thing by God. What about these little babies dying? Well, actually, they're the most fortunate of the whole bunch, are they? They're the ones that hadn't grown up yet to follow in the wicked ways of their parents, and these children are safe. A lot of times we read about God sending the Israelites out, and he says, destroy Amalek, for example. You take the Amalekites to the sword, and you destroy man, woman, and child. And the reason that we get so upset about that is that we have a humanist view of life. That is, we think that the most redeeming virtue in life is the here and now, that the primary emphasis is here. But God is looking at things from the other perspective. And to God, he recognizes that this sphere is just a little probation, just a little time, and human life really isn't all of that important, and then we're in eternity, and that's what counts. We're seeing it from a very limited perspective. So everything, animals, snakes, men, women, children, everything that breathed, perished. Indeed, this was a cataclysmic event. Every living substance was destroyed, verse 23 says, which was upon the face of the earth, both man and cattle and creeping things, and the fowl of the heaven, and they were destroyed from the earth, and Noah alone remained alive, and they that were with him in the ark. And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Now what that's saying is that the waters stayed on the earth 150 days. A lot of people have the idea that Noah got in the ark, it rained for 40 days, and at the end of 40 days and 40 nights he came out and everything was back to normal. But that's not true. You see, when the earth was covered with water, it stays now for 150 days. Now, I'm going to show you in a minute, I believe that this 150 days includes the 40. I don't believe that it rained for 40, and then you had 150 days after it quit raining that it stayed on the earth. But now, they use the lunar month, which means that a month is 30 days, so 150 days is how many months? That's about 5 months. All right, now let's look at chapter 8. And God remembered Noah. Now once again, like that word repented, it repented God that he made man. This is accommodative. Do you think that God was sitting up there and he got to watching television and he forgot about the flood? And so all of a sudden after 5 months, God said, oh yeah, that flood that I had going down on earth. And he remembered Noah. Well, certainly not. Do you remember when you were studying the book of Acts and you were in the 10th chapter and we were talking about Cornelius, and an angel came to Cornelius and said, Cornelius, your prayers have gone up as a memorial or as a remembrance before God. In other words, God hadn't forgotten about the Gentiles, and oh yeah, suddenly heard this Cornelius prayer one time and reminded him that he had also designed that the Gentiles should be saved in Christ. So this is accommodative to our understanding. In other words, God once again looks down on Noah. And every living thing and all of the cattle that was with him in the ark, and God made a wind to pass over the sea, and the waters assuaged. Now the word assuaged, we speak of someone's grief being assuaged. It means calmed. Someone's guilt feelings being assuaged. Sometimes people assuage their own guilt feelings when they should feel guilty. But it simply means calmed. And the fountains also of the deep, now this is the water up in the ocean, and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. All right, so we have the word stopped and restrained. God spoke to it and he stopped it. This is reminiscent to our minds of Jesus when he was out on the sea in the storm. And the disciples came to him and said, "Awake, Master, we perish." And Jesus came out, and do you remember what words he used as he addressed the elements? "Peace, be still." And they said, "What manner of man is this, that even the winds and the waves obey his voice?" God spoke, and the elements heard the Creator, and they stopped. They were restrained. And the waters returned from off the earth continually. In other words, they began to recede. And after the end of the 150 days, the waters were abated. Now, as we said, that's 5 months. Now let's look how this applies. In verse 4 it says, "And the ark rested in the seventh month on the 17th day of the month." Now, this is talking in terms of Noah's birthday. Noah's life, because see verse 11 says, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month and the 17th day of the month," or it might be that in the 600th year, the second month of the year when he was 600 years old, I don't know. But nonetheless, it had started on the 17th day of the second month, and now it is the 17th day of the seventh month. So how many months does that equal? 5, see? In other words, from the second month, the 17th day, to the seventh month, the 17th day, means 5 months. And that's just what we figured out, 150 days. That agrees with what it said in terms of days. "The ark rested in the seventh month on the 17th day of the month upon the mountains of Ararat." Now, because the bottom of the ark is resting on the mountains, it doesn't mean you'd be able to see anything, because the water, you see, is up on the boat, and maybe the bottom touches, but still, you look out and you just see all water. You can't see anything necessarily. And so we're going to have to continue this process. Verse 5 says, "And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month." Now, that would be how many months from the start of the flood? 8. "In the 10th month, on the first day of the month," now, not the 17th day, but the first day, so that'd be 7.5 months, wouldn't it? 7.5 months, "were the tops of the mountains seen." So the ark really came to rest before you could see the tops of the mountains. "And it came to pass at the end of 40 days," that's 40 days after that, "that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. And he sent forth a raven which went to and fro until the waters were dried up from off the earth." Now the raven never came back to Noah. The raven is a scavenger. And I can imagine that there would be a lot out there for a scavenger to eat on and live on. You see the bodies of these animals and people and whatever. And so the raven comes and it goes back and forth, possibly sitting on the top of the ark up there, the roof of it. But it didn't come back into the ark. And so Noah can't use that to tell anything about the condition of the land. Verse 8 says, "And he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters were abated from off the face of the ground. But the dove found no rest for the sole of her foot. And she returned unto him into the ark. for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. Then he put forth his hand and took her and pulled her in unto him into the ark. And he stayed yet another 7 days, and again he sent forth a dove out of the ark. And the dove came in to him in the evening, and lo, in her mouth was an olive leaf plucked off. Now that has become, in our world, a universal symbol of peace, a dove with an olive leaf, a symbol of peace and tranquility. So Noah knew that the waters were abated from off the earth. And he stayed yet other 7 days and sent forth the dove, which returned not again unto him anymore. This time the dove stayed gone. And it came to pass in the 600th year, in the 600th and first year, in the first month, way to get those turned over in there. Okay, Peter? No, that was too gruesome for my system. Paul said, but foolish and unlearned questions avoid, which do nothing but gender strifes. Now, the only condition under which I would answer that question is if I had been lost on the top of a mountain in a plane crash, and there were a few dead bodies up there, and no, I remember when it happened. I remember reading about it in the newspaper when the whole thing happened. After doing that? Yeah. Well, it's such a repulsive thing. I have two thoughts about it. I don't know of anything, certainly under any normal circumstances, that would be an utter sin. It's kind of like the question of the Sabbath, that man was not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath was made for man. All of these rules are for the good of mankind. Sometimes you can find yourself in a paradigm or in a situation that defies all of the normal rules. And as far as there being any virtue or any evil in the flesh itself of these bodies could have been just like animal flesh. They ate it and they survived. I read a book about a guy that fled from a prison camp, and he told about the things that he did to survive, to get out of there. I don't know if some of you may have read it. I've forgotten the name of it. And this particular man, what he did anyway, to survive, what he had to do was he had to hide in an outhouse, for example. And, you know, like one of these old outhouse commode things. And he had to get under there where they pour the lye, and human excrement fell on him, you see. And it outlines the whole thing of how he hid and what he did to survive, which is totally dehumanizing. Now, from the standpoint of my life as a Christian, I think that this whole philosophy is humanistic. Like I was telling you a moment ago, places too much value on this life itself. There are certain humiliations that I would not endure. I would lie down and simply say, God, take my life. You know, to die would be gain. It's the person who does not see death as gain that wants to do anything to survive. That this life is the ultimate, that you must survive at all costs. But I think that the Christian, there are certain things that he just, you know, he wouldn't, the person that gave me this book had great admiration for this person, all that he endured and all that he went through in order to survive. And after I got through, I thought, all that I could think of was what a misplacing of values on this life, when really the life that's really important is the life after this one. Okay, for those who listen to the tape, Dee Dee asked a question about cannibalism. And the moral judgments on the movie survive, whether it be all right to eat flesh or not. They had a tremendous amount of guilt. If they did it, if somebody came back, you know, if someone was a member of the church here at Bel Air and had done something like that, all that I know of that we could say was, well, it was a lamentable situation, and I don't know that we could place any judgments on them and withdraw from them. The thing is over. We're not in the situation. We don't know what we would do. They didn't kill the people. The people were already dead, weren't they? So it's certainly a moral dilemma. There are a lot of times people have asked me questions about abortion. That I can try to give you my judgment from the standpoint, like, is abortion right to save the life of the mother, you know, and what do you do in this situation and that situation? And all you can do is take biblical principles and try to make an application of them, because there are a lot of questions, the one that you just asked included, in which the Lord just did not give a clear-cut, specific answer. I think that I would have died before I would have eaten the human flesh, but I don't know. I wasn't there. If I was there and it was there and I was hungry enough, I don't know what I would have done. Okay. That's a valid question. It's a very good question, and I'm sure a lot of people have questions like this. I'm just sorry that I'm not... I just hope none of us ever find ourselves in a situation like that, with some of these dilemmas. Okay, what verse are we at now? Number 13. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month. Now, of Noah's life, how many months is this now? Or how many, it's the first month, the first day of the month, of the 601st year. Well, we'll say approximately, though, round figures. I would calculate that in terms of Noah's life, this is 10.5 months after the waters start coming down. 10.5 months. The waters were dried up from off the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark, and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. Now, if you can just imagine this was probably like an astronaut sticking his head out of the lunar module for the first time and looking at the surface of the moon. Can you imagine what the earth would look like, you know, for a long, long time? You see, even after the waters went down, it was just like a bog, just like a muddy, sloppy bog. You couldn't have gotten out in it. Verse 14 says, and in the second month, on the 7th and 20th day of the month, so that would be 1 year and 10 days. See? 1 year and 10 days after they went in. And God spake unto Noah, saying, go forth of the ark, thou and thy wife and thy sons' wives. So they were in the ark 1 year and 10 days. David?
If Noah had been 13, mm-hmm. You're saying that the wood was probably all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
What would he be removing to look out?
To get out of it?
Well, to look out.
Well, I would understand possibly, you know, it was a thing like that raised up. Could have been all around. It might have been in sections. Can you imagine all that many animals, what the volume of air, that it gets stuffy in here with just...
It would be open all the time, so what would he be open?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, they might have kept them closed part of the time and opened them part of the time, depending on how the rain was coming down. I don't know. That's just something I would have to speculate about. So God called them out. Verse 17, bring forth with thee every living thing that is with thee, all flesh, both of fowl and of cattle, and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, that they may breed abundantly in the earth, and be fruitful and multiply upon the earth. And Noah went forth, and his sons and his wife, and his sons' wives with him, every beast, every creeping thing, every fowl, and whatsoever creepeth upon the earth after their kind, went forth out of the ark. Now here we're going to find the reason why God said, you take seven of these clean animals, one of the reasons at least. Verse 20 says, And Noah builded an altar unto the Lord, and took of every clean beast, and of every clean fowl, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Now he took one of every one of the types of clean animals. Now, if you consider then how many living things there were left, that everything that was alive now on the ark, in the world, had come out of that ark. Don't you think that a lot of people might have said, well, one or two sheep ought to do. But he takes one of every clean animal and offers it. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor. Now, surely it's possible that there was a sweet smell, but this also is figurative language. The Bible says in the book of Revelation that the prayers of saints waft up before the throne of God as an odor of sweet smell. And the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. I've made the point before that although I do not believe in hereditary depravity, that man inherits depravity, I do believe that mankind is, and I'll use the phrase by nature, totally inclined toward evil, that his heart is ever bent towards doing that which is evil, unless it is guided, unless he allows himself to be subdued by the Lord and the Lord's will, that he always chooses evil. And if that were not so, if there were one exception, I'd like to know. Because, as Paul says, all go astray. They have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. David said, he cometh forth from the womb speaking lies. In other words, that's a hyperbole indicating that before man hardly knows it, he finds himself bent towards sin. And so from the days of his youth, the imagination of man's heart is inclined, or that he has a propensity towards evil. Neither will I again smite any more everything living as I have done before. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. So from the end of till then until the end of time, everything will go as normal until the day of judgment, which will finally end the earth itself. Now, in chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air. Notice that he says replenish the earth. That means repopulate it. This phrase is also used in Genesis 1:28, where God blessed Adam and Eve, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth on the earth. And there are those that suggest then that the creation as we know it and the formation of Adam and Eve was really a recreation, and that at one time before the earth was populated, and because you cannot replenish that which has not been plenished at one time before. Now here we can clearly see that replenish the earth means repopulate it because it's been populated once. But as to whether it had been populated at one time before Adam and Eve, that would be something that would be holy speculation on our part. Jackie?
Verse 42. Do you think this was the first fold of meat in summer and winter?
That thought has never entered my mind. I don't know.
I have heard the same one. I know that it was appeared whole to the fair that it had not rained on the earth. What I heard that it was
It's interesting. It's an interesting theory. I don't know. You know, what we really have here is sort of a skeleton outline, isn't it, of the events as they transpired. Can you imagine if something like the flood just even started on the earth today, the newspaper account of it, tomorrow's newspaper would be covered from the front page to the back with nothing more than news about the deluge. How long would it take you to read a newspaper like a Sunday Houston Post newspaper from cover to cover?
But in this case, the people most involved didn't see it. They were in the ark.
Yeah. I'm making an illustration with respect to the account, the length of the account. See, if a flood just started today, the account of it would be cover to cover in the newspaper. It'd take you a whole day or several days to read the whole thing. And we have, in just a couple of chapters here, the whole thing from beginning to end. So really, it's just a brief account.
But in that verse 22, you know that already we did have seed time to harvest, and we already had day and night. So to suppose that cold and heat, summer and winter were new,
I don't think so. Okay, Genesis 1:14 talks about there being seasons.
Seasons as in periods of time.
Well, if there was no cold and heat, if everything was always the same, then there wouldn't be seasons in any sense of the word.
Well, there would be seasons as in a season of...
As in light and day.
Season of refreshing.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, in that sense of the word, seasons as winter and summer.
Well, if you want to put that in tropical areas, that happens not much season.
Yeah, that's true. One of the things, and this gives me an opportunity, a little springboard to give you a little lecture here. One of the things that the Christian needs to be very careful about is speculative teaching and conjecture. Don't ever be ashamed. See, one of the things that we feel like is necessary many times is that we feel like we always have to have an answer for everything. If God doesn't tell you something, don't be afraid to say, I don't know. I just don't know. Don't be ashamed of that. You take somebody like Garner Ted Armstrong, and if there is a flood in Australia or if there's a tornado in Kansas, he can point to some passage in the Old Testament. He says, see, we knew it all along. Here it is. Here's a whole record of it. And the Bible is just a playground for speculative teaching. And so it's just like in those of you that were in the Corinthians class said, how are we going to judge the world? I said, I just don't know. You know, I don't know all of the ramifications of that. The things that God has revealed clearly belong to us. Those that he hasn't, we don't know. But there are books that are written, entire books that are written on speculative ideas between the lines. You know, possibly this and possibly that. Well, possibly so. I don't know. All right. One thing I wanted to talk to you about at this point for just a minute, deviate here just a little bit, is what we have here is the basic story of the flood. And there is certainly geological evidence all over the earth to support the idea that there was a universal and worldwide flood. Now, when you get into any discussion about the flood and you're talking with somebody that, maybe somebody that goes to Rice University or one of these big schools, you know, and they always come up with wanting real scientific evidence, and they say, well now, how did God, if this were really true, this is obviously just a figure, because how would God literally have gotten all of those animals into this ship? Well, the encyclopedia, in talking about species, says that there are about 500,000 species on the face of the earth. Others say that there are 1 to 3 million. Even these numbers are exaggerated because they have divided these species into so many subspecies. Now, if you take a ship this size and you figure out how many cubic feet it had in it, this ship had in it 3,600,000 cubic feet. Now, if you can just imagine how big that is, and then it was three stories tall, how many railway cars in terms of cubic feet, do you think you could get in it? How many of you think you could get 100 railway cars in there? How many think you could get 500 railway cars in there? How many think you could get 1,000 railroad cars in there? You're right. You could get over 1,000 railway cars. Now, those of you that have ever sat and waited for a train to go by that just had 50 or 60 cars know the volume that a train can pull in terms of railway cars. What if you had to sit at a street down here and wait for 1,000 railroad cars to go by before you could cross the road? The ARC had the capacity of about 1,000 railway cars. Now, you see, one thing that we don't recognize when we think of two of every type is we probably think that God took two chihuahuas in, and he took two poodles, and two German shepherds, and two collies. But that's not true.
Wouldn't you take two pairs? I mean, it's not important. It's just that you talked about 7x7, you're also talking about...
I think so. I think that's probably so. Two pairs of them. Another thing about that is that it's possible... It indicates that they were to take some stuff in for food for them, doesn't it? That they were to feed them. But as far as the breeding problem, we're all familiar with the hibernation. You know, snakes hibernate and bears hibernate certain seasons. I wouldn't, since the whole thing is a miracle anyway, really, since God was in control, it's just like the person that says, well, how was it that Jonah survived in the belly of the large fish? The Bible says God prepared a great fish. I mean, how is it that the stomach acids wouldn't have eaten him up? The fact is, God caused it to happen. And it's very possible that God could have put these animals in a semi-stupor, that they could have all been sort of a state of hibernation where they needed very little air, where there was very little movement. It was he who calmed them down, put them to sleep, so that the whole thing wasn't a billowing turmoil like a zoo. But you see, all horses, I don't care what kind of horses you're talking about, whether it's Appaloosa, or quarter horse, or thoroughbred, or palomino, all come from the same kind of horse. Darwin really discovered this in connection with his theory of evolution, that if you take a bunch of horses of different kinds, palominas and different types, and put them in the same pen and leave them for 1,000 years, and then come back at 1,000 years, you just have male and female of two old mongrel horses. They're just horses. Now, the way you get different species is by selective breeding. If you have two horses, and those horses have a colt, and then has another colt, and has another one, and one of the colts has longer hair than the other, and you start selectively breeding those, then you refine that quality until finally you get one type of horse. So all horses, Shetland ponies, these big horses, what they call Clydesdales, all of them, are simply horses that have been bred from the basic horse refining qualities. And anybody that knows anything about plants knows how by selective cross breeding and so forth, pollination, cross plants pollinate, not breed, okay, that you can develop these different strains. And so the same thing with dogs. All dogs really basically come from one type of dog. And I'm told that of all of the types of animals in the world, that you only have 290 species above the size of a sheep. So what we'll do is we'll take 50 railway cars for the big animals. Now we only have 950 railway cars left. And then we've got our cats and rats and squirrels. And we're going to take everything that is smaller than a rat. Of all of the kinds that you have smaller than a rat, you have about 1,359 species. And so we're going to take 5 cars and put them in. We've got little cages, and we're going to stack them on top of each other. And the average size of all the species is about the size of a cat. See, most of the species are the smaller ones. We have few larger. The average is about the size of a cat. So really, there's no problem. What you have in that ark is really enough room for all of these animals, all of their cages stacked up, and then a bowling alley besides, so that Noah could spend their time pleasurably while they were riding it out for a little over a year. There's no problem in terms of the volume. And the question has always been now, recent years, has the ark been discovered? What happened is number of years ago, actually, when the Tsars were still in control in Russia, there was an expedition that went over there around what is known as Mount Ararat. Actually, there's a group of mountains, the Ararat Mountains, on the border of Turkey and the Soviet Union. And the Tsar sent an expedition up there, and they found this large boat. They said that there was a house that had been built there out of the wood from the ark, and that it had been, the roof had been burned off and it was all charred, and they took pictures and brought back some things, and then later it was all destroyed. And a couple of the people, soldiers that had been on the expedition, eventually immigrated and came over to the United States and told all about it. And there have been a couple other groups that have gone up there, but because of the severe weather on these mountains, they can't hardly go up, and then the Turkish government is clamped down and they just won't give anybody a permit to climb up there. In California, they have a board that was brought down from this thing. Whatever is up there, and it's far above the tree line, you know, you wouldn't normally find any wood up there. And they have this board, and they say, yes, this thing is several thousands of years old. We don't know what it is, but it's several thousands of years old. And of course, we get all in a tizzy when we hear about things like that, and it is exciting. But I always tend to look at events like this with a little bit of a jaundiced eye. There are so many fakes and frauds that my faith in God's word is certainly not going to hinge upon whether they really find the ark or not. I'm sure that they're not going to be able to hold them back too much longer, and we're going to get something on whatever's up there before too many years. And it surely would be a boost for the faith and for the Bible for them to come back and say, yes, there really was an ark up there, and here's what it was like, and dismantle it and bring it down or whatever. That would be, I'll admit, a quite exciting thing. Now, God says, every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. Now, as I said, this is the first time record we have of them saying that animals were to be eaten. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat. So he prohibits their eating blood, just as he did in Acts 15. That's prohibited in this generation. And then he tells them that that the blood of man's life is sacred. If an animal kills a man, that animal dies. In verse 6, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. Now here's the first verse that you read in terms of capital punishment. God has decreed that if a man kill another man, that he die. And this was a universal law that was given to mankind, and I believe that that's certainly valid today. It distresses me that we have taken away the death penalty, and before I left Canada, they abolished the death penalty, said that it was not fitting for a civilized society to have the death penalty. Of course, it's not civilized for the murderers to go out and rape and torture and murder people, but they don't think of that. They think of the one that committed the crime, and their big worry now is, how are we going to hire anybody to be a prison guard? Because here we put people behind bars for life. That's all we can do to them. And the Supreme Court of Canada had also judged that it was cruel and unusual punishment to put a man in the tank, as they call it. You know, this little thing where they put them in isolation. So they have to keep them in a nice, accommodative cell. But now if a guy's in prison and he wants just to make it a hobby to kill prison guards, he can kill however many he wants, and they can't do anything worse than just keep him in a comfortable cell and just try to keep the guards away from him because they can't put him to death. And so this is a very serious thing. And God spake unto Noah and his sons, saying, I will establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you. Now here's where we have that word covenant again. A covenant is an agreement between two parties. In verse 11, he mentions that this is going to be a covenant. It's going to be between everything that lives on the earth. Neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of a flood, neither shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living thing that is with you for perpetual generations. I do set my bow in the cloud. Now why was it that there had never been a rainbow before? Well, very possibly because it had never rained. See? Very possibly because it hadn't rained, and that's the reason there wasn't this rainbow before. And it's a token. Now, a token is a symbol. You see, just like my wedding ring is a symbol. And all of the women know what this means. This means I'm taken. This is a symbol of a covenant that exists between my wife and I. And everybody knows that. And so, you know, the token, the covenant doesn't depend on the token. I can take this ring off and pitch it away, and that doesn't mean I'm not married. Just because you do away with the token. But I might get home and Linda might say, "Now listen, I want you wearing that ring, you know." I keep it on. But it's the token of the covenant. It's not the covenant itself. The Lord's Supper is a token, is a memorial of something, isn't it? How many times, though, do we look up at the rainbow and just think, "Oh, what a beautiful rainbow"? Really, every time you look at the rainbow, you need to think to yourself, this is God's covenant between himself and all flesh. Verse 17, God said unto Noah, "This is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth." God has made an agreement with you. And when you look up at the rainbow, you ought to be touched in your heart and realize God has made an agreement with me that he's never going to destroy the world again by water. And, you know, I think that if I had been Noah and his sons, that after that, if I'd gone through something like that, every time I looked up and saw a rainbow, I would have been exceedingly impressed. I would have said to myself, I know there's a God, and I know that he cares, and I'm going to live a godly life. And the sons of Noah that went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. These are the three sons of Noah. And of them was the whole earth overspread. Now, there's always these questions. Is it possible that some survived? In other words, did the flood just cover the Mediterranean area and over in that part of the world? Or did it cover, what about South America and the American continent? Or was it a limited flood? But this verse says that all men, you and me and every Jew that is alive, every person today on the face of the earth, black, white, or red, or brown, or whatever, sprang from the three sons of Noah. And Noah began to be a husband and planted a vineyard. And he drank of the wine and was drunken. Now, I don't know if it had been a practice to make wine before, or if Noah just discovered this accidentally. You know, he may have just had some of this old grape juice sitting around and it fermented, and lo and behold, he got drunk. And he was uncovered within his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. And he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." Now, you always run into one of these question and answer books on the Bible that says, "Did you know that Noah was a homosexual?" And this is the verse they base it on. And they base it on this idea of when he found out what his younger son had done unto him. I don't believe that there's any validity to that. I think that what happened here is... here Ham goes in and he sees his father in this condition, and he came out and he made light of it. He said, "Guess what, fellas? Daddy's naked. He's lying in there." And the other two sons didn't take it that way. And they recognized this is a very serious matter. They were ashamed of it, and they took this cloth and they went in there and they covered their father's nakedness. It's true that sometimes the word uncovered does mean a sexual act. For example, in the law of Moses, a man is told, "Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy neighbor's wife." And it doesn't just mean you're not supposed to rip her skirt off. It means you're not to have a relationship with her sexually. And to discover someone's nakedness is sometimes used to mean a sexual act. But I can't construe that out of this particular thing. I think that Noah found out that the older son had just made light of this and ridiculed him, and so he cursed the descendant, that is Canaan, the son of Ham. And someone will always ask you another question and say, "Where in the Bible does it say that the Negroes descended from Ham and that they're going to serve the whites?" In other words, really they were intended to be slaves. And this is the verse that they're looking for. Now, we don't know where the Negroes descended from. We don't know whether they descended from Ham or Japheth. I think it was that it was Ham or Japheth, because the descendants of Shem were the Jews. However, it could have been that the Negroes were the descendants of Shem before Abraham ever came along, you see. So really, the Negroes could have descended from any one of these. We don't know. But later on, did you ever hear of the Canaanites before? Where was it that the children of Israel went in to take the land? The land of Canaan. And who was dwelling in it? A group of people called Canaanites. They were the sons, the children, the descendants of this man Canaan. And the Israelites drove them out of the land and occupied the land of Egypt, of Canaan, rather, the promised land. And so that was the fulfillment of this. And he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." And Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Now, really, as to the division of the races, I think that there's a lot that is not in the text, and this is just my theory again, and I tell you I try to stay away from this speculative teaching, but if I had to find an answer for it, I would find it in what in the events that surrounded the Tower of Babel. Not only was the language confounded, and they left off from building the tower, but that was when mankind was dispersed upon the face of the earth. And I don't know whether God did that miraculously, taking some of them and putting them on the American continent, or whether they went over here in canoes, or what. And the Chinese resulted in what. But I think that the races of man as they exist today actually came from the events that attended the events of the Tower of Babel. Now in this 10th chapter, I'm not going to go through it, our time is up. It's really just a genealogical list. Just like in chapter 5, you have the descendants of Adam and Eve. This is just a genealogical thing. And in verse 32, it says, "These are the families of the sons of Noah after their generations and their nations. And by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood." And then in chapter 11, the very next chapter, you're going to have the story of the Tower of Babel and about the dispersion of the race. Any question or comment? Okay, I've enjoyed teaching the class, and Greg will be back with you next week. Thank you very much. Did everyone sign the chart, attendance chart?